You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 586, a talk with record collector, record seller, archivist, Chris Haug.
I don't know how it started, I suppose it was about the 10th grade. I'd never bought much music, I just listened to whatever was played. But there was classic rock there on the radio, and it was blowing my mind. And it was all the records no one wanted now, so they were easy to find. So I started getting LPs, they only cost a little, and these LPs were all the ones I needed from the 60s, with psychedelic art on all the great sleeves, much cooler and much cheaper than the CDs, and that's the way I caught the disease. I caught the disease for LPs. There wasn't any internet, a lot of times you just took a shot. Pretty soon you figured out which records would be awesome or not. If the year was from the 60s, it was probably good bang for your buck. If the year was from the 80s, it was guaranteed to totally suck. I started learning about the LPs, and that's my education just cost rupees. $3 for this Dylan record, oh yes please. And the Cream and Rolling Stones and Arlo Guthrie's. A giant treasure trove was all for pennies, and that's the way I caught the disease. I caught the disease for LPs. By 1994, I had completed all my Zeppelin and Floyd.
Zeppelin and Floyd.
I had all the early traffic, but their later stuff just made me annoyed.
Made me annoyed.
You realize that the radio just scratches at the top of the dirt.
Top of the dirt.
When $4 can buy you Crown of Creation with a lyric insert. So I had a lot of LPs. My friends were mostly clueless. It was just me in an ocean of cheap vinyl like a black sea. I hardly had an income, but it was easy. An awesome world awaited with a cheap key. And someplace in the garbage they were just free. And that's the way I caught the disease. I caught the disease for LPs. And then the 90s ended and I wasn't no teenager no more.
Teenager no more.
But I started getting shakes if I was passing any used record store.
Used record store.
I got the finger muscles you develop when you flip through a stack. Crate digging for the cheap and obscure, and there was no turning back. A total junkie for the LPs, and nothing in the world was gonna help me. You'd see me quit no sooner than see hell freeze. And there was nothing like the thrill of getting lucky. I'd be lying 5 feet to the breeze, 'cause the world was still awash in LPs. And I still had the disease for LPs. Nowadays that stuff is so expensive I don't bother to try. Everything's reissued and plus everything is priced really high. The field is overcrowded, it's impossible to get a good fix. So I walk right past the records and I flip through all the used compact discs. Yeah, nowadays it's mostly CDs. No one wants to keep them, so there's plenty. Folk and punk and private press and rap and indie. Bonus tracks and liner notes are just empty. As long as I can still make a good discovery, I've still got that music hunger disease. That disease that I got from LPs. When they were dirt cheap in the 1990s. Whatever people don't want, that's the time to get it. Take a chance on something, it might blow your mind. And if it's cheap, there's less chance you'll regret it. Though I'm drowning in my stacks because of all the stupid albums I used to try. Nowadays, looking back, I just regret the ones I didn't buy. And we're back. This is John Gentile, and I'm here with special guest Chris Haug. Chris has worked at a bunch of different record stores in the past that I've been to, a lot of cool record stores. He's got one of the craziest record collections I've seen. He's always scoring really cool stuff. He's like, hey, check out this record I got at Goodwill. And the only thing I ever see at Goodwill is like Bing Crosby and like, I don't know, some 10-inch broken Frank Sinatra record, you know, or something. So I don't know how he does it. But also, Chris has an online archive of live shows from Delaware and Philly area from late 90s, early 2000s or so. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, which and it's really cool. And Chris has also been in a couple of bands. So, Chris, thanks for being on the show, dude.
Awesome, man. Thanks for the invite. Good to be here.
So let's talk about your archive. Well, first of all, where can people find your archive on YouTube?
On YouTube, so there's two different YouTube channels that I did. One is Chris Delaware. You can search for that on YouTube, and I have a bunch of my own footage and stuff I've kept in archives since the 90s. But about 3 years ago or so, I started this project with an old friend, Mike Daly, who lives in Philadelphia, archiving his buddy who passed away in the early 2000s, 8mm film collection of the, you know, 90s hardcore and punk stuff. His name was Tim Morris. So you could search for Tim Morris videos under YouTube, and I have a whole plethora of stuff that I archived from his collection.
In the Philly and Delaware area, you see a lot of guys that really treat it as, you know, a special kind of thing. I know the guys from Playa United feel it's special. A lot of the guys from Rain on the Parade feel it's special. I mean, a lot of people that are still in the Philly scene, like, think, oh yeah, like the mid to late 90s was a time. Do you feel as though it was like a special time in music, or do you think just wherever people are at a certain age, it feels special to them? I guess what I'm asking was the 90s Philly hardcore scene unique or better or different than other scenes at the time?
You know, I think it was unique. I haven't really thought too hard on that question, but just thinking about it right now, I think we really did have a special thing. We had a lot of people that would come out and attend the shows, which I think is always, you know, crucial for a good scene. Here in Delaware, when I was growing up, I started going to shows in around 1995. We used to host them at like wherever we could, VFW halls, basements, Girls Incorporated, places like that, because, you know, they'd be all ages. And we'd get upwards to like 300 to 500 kids, you know, on a Friday or Saturday night. You know, a few years later, 97 or so, I started seeing more shows in Philadelphia. And again, you know, places like Stalag 13, you know, which was all ages, they crammed 500 people in there. I think it was also special because we'd have shows, you know, during their heydays, sometimes like 6 times a week, you know, and they were able to support, you know, all those shows for the most part. You know, granted, there was a 300 people that came out to every one of those shows. But I don't know. A lot of bands wanted to come through Philadelphia, I think, at that time. I don't know. I think it was a special thing.
Chris, did I say your name at the beginning of the episode? I can't remember. Did I say I'm talking to Chris Haug? Did I say that?
I believe
that?
You did. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, fair. So in the 90s, do you feel as though the Delaware and the Philly scenes were two separate scenes, or was it basically like the same scene?
No, they were different scenes. Me coming from Delaware, you know, I was definitely influenced by what I was seeing going on in Philadelphia. Well, you know, back it up a little bit, you know, there was cool stuff happening in Delaware in the early 90s. Even in the 80s, we had some cool bands from here and some cool hardcore stuff.
What bands were, you know, popping late or 80s, early 90s, mid
90s? So mid 80s, you know, like Infection was probably one of the first hardcore bands. Sean Pierce, who went on to do the Toilet Boys and a bunch of stuff. He's lived in New York for years now. Zen Gorilla came out of Delaware, you know, that was late 80s, early 90s. You know, they moved out to San Francisco. They were on Alternative Tentacles and Sub Pop for a bit, but they had their roots here. From this flyer archive, which was another thing that I was doing right before the pandemic in relation to the video archive. But I had a bunch of old flyers that, you know, I held on to, and friends that would send me flyers or give me flyers for this project. Some of the stuff in Delaware in the 80s was super cool. You know, like Corrosion of Conformity played, Dag Nasty, a lot of the DC bands came up. I don't know. I think it was just kind of like a good location in between Philadelphia, DC, Baltimore, New York, right there where it was another place to play. You know, if a band wanted to book a tour, you know, 4 or 5 days.
What were some of the, in the 90s, and so what were some of the venues in Delaware that people would go visit? And really, what are some of the venues there? I mean, I know that now there's Oddity Bar. 1984 is closed. I went to a couple of house shows in Delaware in like 2010 or so, but I'm not aware of any houses in Delaware right now. I don't know if you are now, but back in the day, what house show venues were there? What venues were there?
Sure. Yeah, we did house shows. So in the 90s, when I first started going to shows, we had the University of Delaware, which had the Bacchus Theater, and a group of people, they called themselves the Enoch Collective. They used to put on a bunch of shows together. So there was a group of maybe 10 to 15 of them at any given time. And they would book shows through that name, through that collective. So when I first started going to shows, they would do stuff at like Girls Incorporated here in Newark. Basement shows were pretty popular. Just, you know, sometimes it'd be a nice run of, you know, a few months, sometimes, you know, a year, you know, like sporadic. Then in like 97, 98, we started doing shows in a friend's garage. It was called the Gilde Garage, but, you know, we had Dillinger Escape Plan play there, you know, in their early years. Lamb of God, who back then would call Burn the Priest, you know, Boy Sets Fires from here. So we did a lot of shows with them. Yeah, basically wherever we could get a spot, you know, I did shows at pool halls, other friends' basements, you know, whatever we could get, basically, that was all ages. There was a place called The Barn Door. That was cool. That was in Wilmington. Saw Plow United there, you know, numerous times. Bouncing Souls, you know, they come through and they would play like the Girls Incorporated. These days, I'm sure there is a house scene going on, but I don't know. I'm not as privy to that these days. I've gone to a couple probably in the last like 3 years, but I'm sure there's more than I'm aware of. But yeah, Oddity Bar is a cool spot. The Jackson Inn in Wilmington, they've been doing some cool stuff, indoor and outdoor over the summer. I think during the pandemic, they were doing a lot of outside shows. Those are like the two spots right now. Unfortunately, we don't really have anything in Newark other than maybe some underground house shows that I just haven't really seen much on.
Chris, referring to Newark, Delaware, which is, I guess, southwest of Philadelphia or so, not Newark, New Jersey, which is in New Jersey, obviously. Right. So, Chris, I mean, you mentioned a couple, but what are some of the standout or like crazy shows you saw in the Delaware scene in the 90s or early 2000s?
Dead Guy was a fun one. That was a good memory for me, seeing them in like 96, I think. So I was probably, you know, 14 years old, really impressionable, and they were just crazy, loud, chaotic. That Burn the Priest show we did was killer. I actually have footage of that on that YouTube channel, I think, under Chris Delaware, if anybody wants to watch that. It was with Dillinger Escape Plan, Boy Sets Fire. I did a house show for the German band Morser. That was actually a pretty funny story. It was supposed to be at the University of Delaware. I had a contact who was a bit older than us. He was in college and I was in high school. And we would go through him and his organization through the radio station, I believe, to book shows. I would book it. I would promote it, do everything. He would just rent me the hall or rent me the space and the room. And oftentimes, more than a few, this guy would flake out. You know, probably on the third or fourth, I stopped dealing with him. But I remember I had this big show with Morser from Germany, you know, grindcore band, you know, four singers. I was super into him. It was a big deal. And we show up at the university and, you know, they say, we don't have that room booked for you. So I'm scrambling around. I'm trying to find another place for it. And, you know, I call everybody I know, you know, it's pre-cell phone. So I'm on the phone at the university calling everybody I know. And eventually, like, somebody's like, yeah, my parents are out of town. You know, you could do it at our house. And it was right over the line in Pennsylvania. And I think like Lannenburg, which is maybe 10 minutes outside of Newark, Delaware. So yeah, we moved the show there, and you know, 200 people show up, and it was a blast. You know? That was a good time.
So, was the band like mad at you? Were they like, how dare you book this show? Were they pissed off, or was that super
cool? No, but I do remember another time. I don't know if I should say the band's name. They were active, it's pretty recent, but Philadelphia band. You know, they showed up same sort of situation with the same guy. You know, this might have been a few months before, and didn't have the room. They were pissed. And I said, look, you know, I tried my best. You know, this is what happened. I apologize. We're trying to move it right now. And they were angry and they stormed off and left. But I actually did find a house for the rest of the show to happen. And a band from Pittsburgh, Creation's Crucifixion, was on that bill too. And they were super appreciative. They, you know, went with the flow. They said, sure, you know, whatever you got, we'll play. And they played this house and it was awesome. You know, all the kids that came out, you know, from the university to this, you know, filled the basement and it was fun. But no, Morser were super cool. They were appreciative and, you know, partied all night long.
I'm trying to think of what Philadelphia band it was. A Philadelphia band that's still active that was pissed and stormed off. I'm going to say, let me see. I mean, it have to be a punk or punkish band.
I think they might have been on Relapse Records towards the tail end of their...
I still have to Relapse Records band.
I saw them in Delaware again in like 2007. They toured with High on Fire. You know.
I probably don't know off the top of my head.
I already did play Wilmington, Delaware, though. That was a good show. That was in, I think, 2007. We got them. That was probably around the end of like me booking stuff, though. I had some friends that, you know, I'd help put shows together, but they kind of took the reins around like 2007. I just got burnt out with promoting myself. But I was playing in bands around that time. So, you know, I'd.
So, like, what bands were you in?
Oh, I think the first band I was in and kind of playing shows with or touring with was a band called Giant Bags of Weed. That's when I lived in Bloomington, Indiana. And I met some other folks that were from Chattanooga, Tennessee. They did like This Year Records. They asked me to play bass with them. So played a handful of shows, and did some recordings. Then I moved back to Delaware. Oh no, I moved to the Pirates Cove in Allentown in 2003. Which is a super cool house that, you know, did tons of shows. Mastodon actually played our basement. That was a big one. Lots of international bands came through. I played some music with those kids there, but I don't think we recorded anything. And fast forward, moved back to Newark in 2004, and started playing in a band called Take Down Your Art. And we toured the States, I think maybe two or three times. Then shortly after that, I was in a band called Count Von Count. We toured, you know, a handful of times over the series of maybe, ooh, I don't know, 5 years. I've played in a lot of other projects during that time, but most of it just kind of local. We'd have records or CDs, but didn't tour too much.
When you were out in Bloomington, did you ever like run into the Squirt Gun guys, that whole scene?
No, Squirt Gun might have been right before I moved out there. They were 90s, is that right?
Yeah.
I feel like I might have saw them in Philly or Delaware sometime in the 90s. But when I was out there, it was more like the Planet X crowd was kind of getting established. And then there was like Secretly Canadian Records. They had some cool stuff that I'd like to go and see. But mostly like the Planet X, I think, bands were active around that time. So it was like 2000, 2001. 2002.
So, like, did you see like Early Against Me out there?
Against Me played my drummer's house, drummer of Giant Bags of Weed. That was a fun show. You know, This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb would always come up and play. Like, that was, I think, like their second home during that time. I remember seeing This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb probably, I don't know, 15, 20 times when I was there during that time. That was a fun scene. We did a lot of guerrilla, like outside shows, like at parks, you know, just like generator shows. Played in a couple other bands then too, I'm just remembering, but I don't think we ever recorded or toured.
Did you ever see Sufi Nun Squad? I'm just curious. That's an obscure band that
they
I like.
They were friends as well, yeah. Arkansas folks. That was always a good time. They came through Bloomington a lot. They had another band too called Temioski. They were more like Iron Maiden or like Thin Lizzy kind of style guitars. Kind of like what's that Philly band that's around now that kind of has that twin guitar and Lizzy style? Shoot, their name just escaped me. You would know them if I said them, but they're fairly popular. But anyway, Temioski was cool. They were like in that vein too, but it was probably three members from Sufi Nun Squad. I think Nate Powell was in that as well. Those bands came through a lot. That was fun.
Apparently there was a band called Henry Rollins and the Sweater Band. Do you know what that was or is?
No, it's a band without Henry Rollins. They were just that's in their name.
No, it's called Henry Rollins and the Sweater Band. I don't know if that is Henry Rollins or what that is.
I haven't heard of it. You think they're out of Bloomington?
They relate to Planet X somehow.
Okay.
Anyways, fair enough. So Chris, you've been actually. Let's talk about the Philly scene for a hot minute. So you used to go to a lot of Philly shows, right?
Yeah, early U Church shows. You know, early R5, I guess, even before Sean was calling it R5. I caught some of those early ska shows, like in '96 or so, at the U Church. But my favorite venue had to have been Style of 13. That was Tony Pointless, Andrew Martini, Mikey Goat Boy. Rest in peace. Yeah, those guys were just doing a really, really cool thing. I saw lots of good music shows there.
So I guess that kind of... Stalin 13 was a DIY. Was it a house or was it a building?
Stalin. It was a house that was then, you know, I think squatted for a bit, but then, Tony lived there. Andrew, I think, was there for a minute. But yeah, it was a warehouse. They would just pack, you know, 300-400 people in there, you know, for shows.
And was that on Lancaster Avenue, I think, or Route 1?
It was right around like 38th and Lancaster. Actually, I found out now, I think it's a gym. And there was an episode a few years back on Queer Eye. Is that the show? Like a Showtime show or something where they go in different cities or whatever. But they did Philadelphia for a month or whatever. And they had this episode where the guy who took over Stalag 13, he has like a gym there now, and they make him over. Whatever, but I thought that was pretty cool seeing what it's like now because it's completely different.
Stalag 13 is a famous Philly venue. We'll talk about the FU Church shortly. But Stalag 13, like, was the place like just a wrecked punk house? Was it clean? And how, like, were the shows really crazy or like not that crazy? Because is it famous just because a lot of shows were there, or was it famous because it was out of control? Or both?
I think it was famous because there was a lot of shows there. I think in the early days, I think the first show might have been in 1994, and I didn't start going there until 97 because I was, I guess at that time, I don't know, 14 years old, 15 years old. I think the early days, it was pretty, you know, drunk punk, whatever, you know. But then, you know, Tony Pointless moved in there. Tony of Rambo kind of cleaned it up a little bit. But I have memories of like Tony like saying to us, hey, if you kids want to come and like clean up all the broken bottles from the night before, you know, I'll let you in the show for free. So we always get there a little early and like help straighten up, clean up, throw the trash out, and then, you know, we get to see the show for free. So we did that a lot. We'd sometimes stay there too. He'd let us like crash, you know, because it'd be like 2 o'clock in the morning, and he'd say, yeah, you know, bands are hanging out, you know, you guys can crash, you know, on the stage, whatever. So we used to do that so we didn't have to drive back down the Delaware. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was fairly clean, I think. At that point, but that kind of brings me to the record thing. When Andrew Martini was doing shows there, he used to set up his, he called it his distro, but he'd have like two folding tables in the back with, you know, a bunch of records, CDs that he just get from different distributions. So I really took to that idea and, you know, asked him for a couple of his contacts, or he would give me catalogs. So I started doing that in Delaware. So I was probably like 98, 99. So I would set up and sell records at shows in Delaware and sometimes Philly.
Who would you get records from? Like what distros, or would you just go and like pick up used ones?
So I get like Barry distribution, Barry's catalogs, Relapse Records would have catalogs. With the Heart Attack, you know, Galita, those guys, you know, they sell. Oh, Ebullition, you know, I get stuff through them, like through the hardcore stuff. But yeah, it was basically just be able to like afford the habit, because you know there'd be stuff that I want 7 inches. 45s that I would pick up, so I just grab 5 of them or whatever, and then you know, sell them for $3, and then, you know, I get my copy for free and get a couple extra bucks to fund, you know, the next shipment or whatever. I think I was doing that pretty hard in like the late 90s.
We'll get to the present in a second, but you know, right now it's my estimation that records are very popular right now. Then in the punk scene, were records like super, like if you bought 5 records for a distro, did you know that you're going to sell them no problem, or was there danger of getting like stuck with a lot of stuff? Like did you have to worry about what people did and did not want, or would people just buy whatever you had basically?
No, so that's a good question. So I had maybe a few friends that I knew with I could, you know, turn people on to certain things that I was into. At that time, I think it was more into like grindcore, crust punk, stuff like that. And there weren't many people in Delaware that I knew that would buy stuff like that. So I take a chance, you know, I get like 4 copies and, you know, some of that stuff sit, but I would also get stuff from Ebullition or a more popular, you know, stuff from Barry, like hardcore 45s that I knew would move, that maybe necessarily I wasn't into, but I would keep a copy, but I knew I could sell. Mm-hmm. I also get stuff from bands that came through too, you know, buy like 5 copies of their CD or whatever they had, their 45s for my distro, and, you know, try to sell them after they left town. But yeah, it was always a gamble, you know, back then too, I think. I remember going to your recent Enterprise and Leftover Crack. I remember getting the Crack Rock Steady 7-inch. I probably got like 10 copies of those because I thought I could move them because there was kids around here that liked that. And
too big to hang on to them, Chris. Those are worth $200 each.
I bought out a friend's record collection. It's not in the punk anymore, probably like 3 or 4 years ago. And he had three copies left. I guess at some point he got three of them. I don't know why, or maybe a couple friends gave him their copies, but I got them again, probably about like 3 years ago. Have since sold.
Is it maddening to know that records you sold for $4 are now worth $200, $300, $400?
Nah, I think it's fun. I think that's a part of the fun. Yeah. Cause there's stuff I held on to too, that I got for $2, $4 that are, you know, now worth a lot more.
So you've worked at some record stores in the past. I know you worked at Jupiter Records for a while. You're not there anymore, but I mean, you're on good terms with them. Jupiter Records is a record store I like a lot. How did you get involved in working at record stores, and what was the first record store you worked at?
So here in Newark, we had Rainbow Records. I would always visit them, and I have a job where I was off in the summer, so I would always ask if I could help out in the summers at Rainbow. But at that time, they would never need help. I was always a little bummed because I always wanted to work at a record store. Fast forward, I think when I lived in Bloomington, Indiana, going back to that 2001, I helped open up a radical bookstore, kind of like the Wooden Shoe in Philly. And
I'm going to interrupt you. I was just at the Wooden Shoe for the first time ever, like 2 weeks ago. How does a place like that stay in business at all? Dude. I mean, I'm not trying to be a dick. Who's buying? I was in there. It was like dead air, man. I'm like, how is this guy paying South Street rent? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. I don't know if they were grandfathered in or what, because they've been there for a long ass time. Since the 70s, maybe? I started going there in the mid 90s, right? Getting cool books from them. I was thinking about that the other day, too. I was in West Philly and I passed the A Space. And that's another venue or place that's been around for, you know, 30 some years. Crazy that they're able to stay alive. But, I helped some folks in Bloomington open up a spot similar to those spaces, and I would order the records for them. So I guess that's kind of like the early venture of that. But then I think in 2014, Steve, the owner of Jupiter, just asked if I wanted part-time work. And he opened up a few other stores during that time. He had the original location on Marsh Road in Wilmington, but I helped him open up one in New Jersey, another one in Delaware, and then another one in Pennsylvania during that time. Steve's great. The one on Marsh Road is still there. So, yeah, definitely check him out. I also help out at a place called Good Boy Vinyl, which is actually a longtime manager of Jupiter Records, Blaine. So he has a spot on Kirkwood Highway in Wilmington, Delaware, which is great. So. Yeah.
So the listeners hear me talking about records I picked up and my experience at the record store. Chances are I'm either talking about my experience at Good Boy, at Jupiter, or at Sit and Spin. Those are the ones that I hit up the most, or maybe Electric Avenue up in Westchester. Let's talk about working at a record store. First of all, is it fun working at a record store? It seems fun. Are you having fun at the record store?
I think it's great. Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. I have a Monday through Friday gig, which is not that fun. It's kind of like the escape. It's the hobby. I love talking about music. I love talking about music all day long. So, you know, I can do that for 8 hours with people and turn people on to new music. I think that's great. Yeah.
One thing that I've noticed, and I'm not going to call anybody out, and I try not to do this. I'm probably guilty of it a little bit, but I really try not to do this, is like the clerk will be standing behind the counter and a regular will come in and he'll be like, did you check out the new Clapton box set? And the clerk said, no, I haven't gotten to it yet. So essentially saying, I don't really care. And the person will talk about Clapton for like 20 minutes. What do? Do you just sit there and take it, Chris? Or what do you do?
There's certain punishers that I can take, or there's regulars that have conversations with me like that. And, I can fear it to something else that both of us are more interested in. But there's some punishers that I just can't take. And I just got to leave the room or put my hands up in the air. But no, I don't mind the Clapton fan that talks to me about Clapton for however long it's like to come off.
This is a word we have thrown around. Like, what is a punisher? Because I know there's a couple of different definitions of a punisher, but from the record store perspective, what is a punisher?
I suppose somebody that just talks your ear off, you know, or well, just look at the what's the Instagram page, Punisher Zine. She's great. She has tons of different punishers that I've seen them all. You know, the person that brings in their moldy record collection that thinks they're worth a fortune. You know, that just won't leave. The person that just talks your ear off about something that you're not interested in. Yeah.
do you have the sympathy for the Punisher because you're like, this is the best thing this guy's got on gone on all day long? Like him torturing me, that's all he's got, man. Like, do you have some sympathy for the Punisher, or is that used up after like the first week?
No, I can handle most of them. I say that to some of my friends who work in record stores. You know, I can handle most Punishers that don't really, you know, get under my skin too much.
How can one determine if one is a Punisher and doesn't know it?
So I could be a Punisher. Who knows, right? Yeah. So I frequent all the local spots and I dig through everybody's dollar bins. So I don't know. I don't think I punish though. I'm, you know, pretty quiet when I go in and out and grab my digs and, but yeah, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe we're both Punishers.
In my perspective, it's poor form to like check out the price of a record on Discogs while you're at the store, unless it's like a super expensive record. Do you agree with that? Because at record stores, at the ones we've talked to, there'll be dudes whipping out like $15 Pink Floyd records and going clack, 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 clack. Is that
poor form, annoying.
Or
yeah.
Is that fair game? Is that fair
I
game?
Know, I think it's annoying, but I'm guilty of doing it a little bit, like when I'm down in the dollar bins and I see a bluegrass record that I'm not familiar with. And I'm like, oh, this looks like a thing. You know, I could just take a chance because it's a dollar. I could, you know, see if it's something worth me picking up. I think it is a little bit bad for busting out. And then, you know, comparing and saying, oh, this is $5 more. I can get it for this price on Discogs. You know, who cares? Doing it for so long, I kind of have, I don't know, I have the memory of what a lot of stuff is worth in my head or, you know, going for lately. So I don't necessarily need to do it. Maybe some other people do need to.
So you're saying as long as you do it on the sly and not like out in the open, that's kind of okay.
I think people should do it on the sly.
That's not the best.
Yeah, I think you should do it on the sly.
Fair enough.
Yeah. About your phone. Yeah.
I do get so annoyed.
What do you do, John? You ever take out the phone? You just take the chance.
I definitely have been guilty of doing it on the sly. I try not to do it that often, especially on cheap stuff. If it's an expensive thing, well, maybe that's kind of fair because like if you're buying a car, you're allowed to compare prices. You know what I mean? But like, you know, the $5 or $10 thing, you know, either you
or you, you've been looking for a record. Yeah, let's say you've been looking for a record for a year or two and you remember it being a $50 record and it finally turns up and, you know, the store's asking $150. I think that's fair. You know, look it up, see what it's going for these days.
And on the other hand, is sometimes it looks like you're looking up the price, but you're really just looking to see if you have it. Like if you've got like some 12-inch single or something. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean? That's fair game, I say. But
from the outside looking,
it looks like the same thing, you know?
Yeah, honestly, John, I can't remember the stuff that I have down here in this basement. So when I'm out and about, I got to, you know, check to see if I have that pressing or, yeah.
So, Chris, both you and I are dollar store vultures. I mean, you know me, man. I'm always crawling through that dollar. I guess the first question is back in the day, in my late 90s, early 2000s, all the way through like 2007, I got some really awesome stuff. These days, I feel as though it's much less really awesome stuff, but you can still get a good hit once in a while. Would you agree? Is that your perspective of the dollar bin these days?
Absolutely. It was definitely much easier back in the late 90s, early 2000s when I was doing it as well. I think a lot more people are doing it too. A lot more people are hitting up the thrifts or, you know, the dollar bin. So you have competition. That's for one. A lot of it is still like right place, right time. You know, I tell people usually that my ratio might be like 1 out of 20, sometimes 1 out of 30 where I find, you know, something really cool or really good. And the rest of the times it's, you know, that, but yeah, I mean, I'm addicted to that, that feeling or that find, you know, getting that cool thing, you know, the diamond in the rough, you know, digging through the dollar bins or digging through the thrift stores. So yeah, I still go out. I probably go out just about every day. Sometimes I take off on Sundays. Today's Monday. I had off work. So I went out digging, but yeah, I think I took off yesterday. I didn't go out anywhere.
Is it poor form to be the complete dollar bin vulture and pull all the fruit and leave the dead chaff behind? Or is that part of the sport and that's fine?
I think it's part of the sport and that's fine.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so if it's something that I already have. Yeah, if it's something that I already have, I know that a friend wants it. You know, I always pick it up for them. And, you know, if it's a $10 record that I found for a dollar, you know, I'll trade a friend. You know, hey, you know, you got that $10 record I'm looking for. Let's go trade. I found this. So I always keep stuff on for that. But I also do record pop-ups. I do like monthly pop-up at a local brewery in Wilmington. So, you know, I'll go around and find stuff sometimes for a dollar, you know, if it's, you know, clean enough and I think it's worth a little bit more. You know, I'll clean it up, you know, throw it on the VPI, throw it in a bag, you know, put a new inner sleeve on it and bring it out to these events and then, you know, be able to. Chris, people on the
should we give the people the details of the Wilmington pop-up, or you don't want to do that?
Oh, sure. No, I think that'd be cool.
So Chris does this really cool pop-up. It's essentially a pop-up record convention, and or however you want, like a bunch of dudes, some shops and some of just dudes. Chris has them come down to a place called Wilmington Brew Works on the fourth Tuesday of every month in Wilmington, called Wilmington Brew Works. And they just have a bunch of cool records for sale. And a lot of stuff is kind of cheap sometimes, and a lot of stuff is fair price. And it's real cool. I've gotten a lot of cool stuff there. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's like the punk rock flea markets. We used to do those, you know. There was Philly one for years, or a couple different Philly ones, but yeah, kind of bringing that mentality back. But yeah, I invite all the local shops. If they want to come out, they have a table. And then I invite other dealers, friends that might have stuff. So yeah, it's actually this next Tuesday, January 25th. If anybody wants to come, it's from 6 till 9. And I believe I have 6 local shops, a dealer from Lancaster, and a dealer from New Jersey, and then myself that are coming out. So yeah, there should be like 8 tables worth of records and CDs to parade through.
Well, I'll be there, people, so come on by. Chris, would you agree that used records now are more popular than they've ever been ever? Would you agree?
I would agree with that, yeah. Other than when it was the only format, right?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And
go ahead.
And would you agree that used records are more expensive than they've ever been before?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, it is what it is. It's a bummer when it's something that I want that I have to pay a lot more for that, you know, I missed out on. Let's say like 5 years ago, it was, you know, $10, $15 record, and I didn't pick it up for whatever reason. Now I want it, and it's, you know, $50, $75 record. But I don't know. It's all good. I think it's fun. I like finding or trading, you know, for some of those rare records or more expensive records with other folks. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I often wonder, you know, when's the bubble going to burst? You know, it's been going now for a few years now, right? But yeah, I always think there's going to be.
So that's the next one. Do you think? I think this is going to be the year where it drops off a little, and the next year significant, and then the year after that significant, and then it'll steady out. Do you think we're headed towards? Because I mean, look at it this way: Beanie Babies, everybody wanted Beanie Babies, or Pogs, everybody wanted Pogs, and then when everybody got them, hits the floor. Vinyl sales had their how long? I don't know, like yeah, 2 years maybe.
Okay,
like two years. So I, you know, the Christmas 2021 was the highest new record sale since they started tracking that, which was 1991. Used record sales are way up. I think this is going to be the year where things drop off a little. Do you see that? Or because when I talk to most record store owners, I'm like, well, so what do you think is going to happen? They're like, golden days ahead forever. And I'm like, I don't see that happening. What do you see happening?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to drop off. I probably agree that it's going to start steadying down, and we're probably going to see an influx of all those record store day titles, and I don't know, maybe like the Fleetwood Mac, you know, reissues coming into the record stores that, you know, people are selling. But I don't know. I wonder, like the people that really got into the hobby, I think are going to stick around, and they might, you know, hold out for a bit. You know, you saw like in the 90s, you know, we were like more like punk stuff. But during that time, like the Acid Archives, you know, the stuff from the 70s was really big with record collectors. And that never really died down. Those records held their value for, you know, over 30, 40 years now. So even though those people then are getting older, I think there's new people that are getting into the hobby that are in the stuff like that, or let's say like, you know, like these Blue Note Jazz, you know, is that going to go away? Are those records go down in value, or will they stay steady? Who knows? Yeah, I'd like to think that the hobby will continue with people that are really in the music and into records, but, it'll definitely die down from where we're at right now with it being so huge, you know?
Is the format vinyl record compared to CD or even digital, is that important at all?
No, I've always liked records. I got into vinyl. So I guess when I've always liked music, I guess we'll just start saying that, like a family member share memories of me as like a 4 or 5 year old with my Fisher Price record player, like just bringing it everywhere and playing 45s for people. So I guess, you know, like the early DJ technician, like, you know, you have to hear the song. So I've always kind of had that. Then I guess late 80s, I was more into cassettes. You know, they were more affordable, easier to get. But then, you know, when CDs came around after the cusp and they stopped making as much vinyl, everybody was getting rid of their vinyl. And as a young middle schooler, you know, I couldn't really afford an $18 CD. So I'd get, you know, my parents or aunts, you know, Led Zeppelin records. Then I remember when I was around like 12 years old, going to a thrift store and buying Black Sabbath's Masters of Reality. And that was the first record I got at a thrift store for $1. And it blew my mind. And I don't think I've ever gone back since. So, I've always liked records and cassettes. I have a shit ton of CDs, too. I prefer vinyl. It's, you know, I love the artwork. It's mostly what I collect. But, you know, if something was only released on cassette, you know, I'll pick up the cassette. Bands' demos that are only on CDs, you know, I pick up the CDs. I've held onto those. So I just, I have a house full of music.
Chris has got a crazy record collection, and he's always like, oh, look, not only he got like a Hawkwind record, for like $1 or something, I could have strangled the guy. Chris, what are the secrets to getting, first of all, Hawkwind were on the edge of time. These days, that's like a $30 to $40 record in good condition. Would you drop $30 to $40 on a record, or are you like, no, I want strictly $1 to $3 to $5 records that I get on a good pick? You know what I mean?
Oh, God. John, I just bought a record for $150 today. You know, I often go high.
What record?
Embryo, their fifth record. So Good Boy Vinyl got this really cool collection, and he's been letting that trickle out over the last few days, and he has a lot more to put out as well. But he a lot of like German, you know, krautrock, cosmic music, a lot of cool stuff. So, you know, oftentimes, like I've gone as high. I think the most I spent is probably $370 on a single album. But I to afford the hobby, I often buy the dollar records to, you know, sell for a little bit more, flip, whatever you want to call it, and then put that money towards, you know, $100 record or $200 record. So no, I do buy expensive records as well. Finding Hawkwind records for $1, but I have spent.
So how do you do it? How does somebody find some?
Oh man, just right place, right time. You know, that's all it is. Flea markets, you know, get up early. You know, get out there at 7 o'clock. Start talking to the guys. Thrift stores, I just hit 2 or 3 thrift stores up. I used to do it every day, like 2 or 3 thrift stores. Now I'm down to like I do a different thrift store, one a day. So after I get off work, you know, I hit up a thrift and I just have my rounds. So yeah, I just make my rounds all week long. And, you know, eventually after maybe the 20th visit, you know, you find a Hawkwind record and, you know, it's cool. Where you find more, you know, sometimes Goodwill wheels that shopping cart out and you're there at that time and you get a shit ton of classic rock records, you know, at a Goodwill. But, you know, like I said, there's a lot of competition now. So a lot of retired guys are out there. They're doing it too. And they're making their rounds. So get a little harder
along those lines, and maybe I'm just a misanthrope, but you know, I definitely hit up the flea markets, and I don't hit up Goodwills too much, but you know, thrift stores sometimes. But man, you get the people with the bad BO, the people that are shoving into you, the dudes that you can tell like only leave their basement to get records, only to retreat back down to their basement. You know what right. I'm saying, Chris? Even the record convention, man. Like I love the record convention, and honestly, I think record conventions are less mouth breathery than they used to be. I think, but still, man, sometimes you get that dude that, like, you know. First of all, let's establish a rule. If you're at the record convention and there's like 5 rows of records, do you agree that the rule is while someone is flipping through that row, no one else should flip through that row, but the people can go to the rows next to them? Fact or fiction?
Yes. No, fact. So, etiquette. So all about etiquette at those things. Yeah.
You're at the convention, the mouth breather, like, does the reach over or whatever? And you're like, bro, how do you deal with these people, Chris? Because, man, I'm at the end of my rope with these guys. You know?
Serenity. Actually, now, John. Serenity now.
I was at the last. I think you know this guy. I'm going to go to Vegas. I really don't like this guy. this is going to sound incredibly pathetic. So, at Jupiter Records, when Jupiter Records had their first record store day, anti-record store day thing, where they brought in a whole bunch of really cool records instead of the record store day, there's this tall guy, he's got gray hair and it's kind of curly. I'm not going to describe him more. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, that sounds like a couple guys. What age?
Anyways, I don't know. Anywhere from 50 to 65. Okay. I think he's got glasses. I think he wears a vest maybe. Anyways, I think like everybody knows this guy, and I'll tell you why. Because so I'm there, I'm flipping through the row, and the dude does the reach over. I'm like, bro, you know, and I kind of scared him away. And I see him around once in a while. I try not to interact with him. I got a point on top of that. So then I was out at the Lancaster Record Convention not that long ago, and I'm going through a row, and there's ones on the floor. And so I dropped down, and sure enough, this dude is reaching over me to get to the rope. Mm-hmm. I'm like, bro, I don't think I said bro. I think I said, listen, man, I'm going to be done here literally in 2 minutes. Can you just wait? And like he said, he didn't want to. I said, listen, I don't want you reaching over my head. And he says, well, I don't understand that. And I said, honestly, I'm like, I felt so badass. I'm like, well, that's too bad. And like I gave him like the mean mug, and he like ran away. And
you
I
was stand your ground. And then, yeah.
And then I'm talking to this kid next to me. I'm like, man, I think that guy's got a problem or something. And then the kid was like his kid or like his neck. Anyways, so where am I going with this?
Oh, that's
so,
great.
So anyways, do you deal with these creeps, or is it only me that has like some kind of creep attractor?
No, definitely. Yeah. And mostly I find it to be at like, the Keystone Record Convention or some of the other bigger ones. WFMU. I don't see that as much more in the thrift stores, I think, because, they're not doing drops where people know when to go and check stuff out. So I haven't really dealt with like the thrift store, Punisher mouth reader in a while.
I mean, those dudes are usually pretty wimpy. I mean, they're rude, but they're wimpy. So if you mean mug them, they run away. What do? Yeah. You mean mug them.
I think I've said just straight up like, I'll just be done in a minute. Just, step off, right? I'd like to think of like the events that I'm having at Wilmington Brew Works. We haven't dealt with any of that yet. I've been doing them now since May, and I think everybody's been really respectful. We've had good crowds. We haven't really dealt with any of that, which I think is great. I haven't, at least.
I haven't seen it. I think some of the people kind of stand too close to you, but I think it's just because they don't really know. So they're not trying to be rude. They just don't know. You know what I mean? So.
Well, they should know we are in the middle of a pandemic. So,
Honestly, like. I think I've gotten a little weird during the pandemic in that I actually was up at Revilla Grooves, a record store Chris likes. I was at Prison Record Exchange.
Love that store.
And people have been like standing like near me, and they've really irritated me just by existing sort of near me. And I think that's because of the pandemic. I'm like, why are you here? I've gotten kind of weird with regards to that. I don't know if you have or what. So
I just say etiquette, man. Yeah, I always wait. If I see somebody digging in the new arrivals and I want to be over there, I just wait. I find another section, another area to go through first, and then I wait my turn. But I don't know.
And actually, so a lot. I felt this pain. You probably have, because we are classy guys, and most people are classy guys or girls. But like, you're sitting there, and like they online. Actually, this happened to me down at a Good Boy. Good Boy had a whole bunch of Hawkwind records, and one that I particularly wanted. I was like, ooh. So I go on down there, but there's a guy in you're going through the row. And I'm like, no, don't pick it up, don't. And he picked it up, Chris. I'm like, put it back, and he put it back. And I was like, nice. But have you felt that pain where like you're trying to be polite, and the guy's,
Definitely. So I think I've been bold enough sometimes to say, "Ooh, can I see that one?" when somebody pulls it out. But then I to get too curious about it. But it's all part of the fun.
It's the measure of a person if he or she will wait while the person goes through it, rather than going for the snatch and grab, even though it's rude. What if actually, Chris, on the reverse side, there's a guy that comes to the right, and then we'll get a little bit more concrete, because Chris and I are kind of telling inside stories, but I'm hoping the listeners catch what we're dropping. But what I'm saying is, there's a friendly guy down at Good Boy. He's, I don't know, maybe he's 45, and he's like into a whole bunch of music. And one time you guys had like a cool drop, and there was a Dead Milkman record I didn't have, and I picked it, and I put it in my stash. But I, hid it between the things because I didn't want people to see that I was carrying it. And the guy's walking around the store. Did anybody see the Dead Milkman record? But I had it. But I felt bad. But, the rule is kind of first come, first serve. You know what I mean? So, I don't know.
Of course. I see it all the time. I saw it this past Saturday where somebody was looking for something, or they came down for something. And I was like, oh, it was in the bit this morning. And I looked through. It's probably in there. I haven't sold it yet. And the person walks out empty-handed, or they find something else, and then somebody else that's walking around the store says, "I got it first."
So I mean,
you don't have to say anything.
Like, if it's first come, first serve, and you want it and you snatch it up, I mean, I kind of think it's fair. It sucks for the other guy, but I think it's fair hunting. What do you
absolutely
say?
I agree. I have one funny story about when I used to work at Jupiter. Steve used to do the drops on Saturdays where he'd put out all the new stuff for the week on that day. So we typically got a line of people waiting at, opening to get in there first to get the record that they saw and wanted or heard about, whatever. But there's two people talking in line. This one woman came all the way from Lancaster saying that she wanted such and such record. She really hopes she gets it. And the guy behind her was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. If I see it, I'll let you know. And she's like, oh, that's great. Yeah, I just drove, an hour to get it. I've been looking for years. It'd be really cool. And like, yeah, I'll let you know if I see it. She was one of the first people in there. She looked all through the new arrival bins, didn't see it. Shopped for a bit longer. She talked to me about it and, you know, whoever else was at the counter. We said, you know, I was there this morning. You know, I haven't sold it yet. And this woman ends up walking out empty handed. And she was super bummed. She's like, you know, did you guys put it out? And we're like, yeah, you know, we put it out. I know it was in those bins. Lo and behold, we searched that entire store later that day because we could not find it. And about a week later, Miner, who was working there, reached up on top of one of the ducks and found the record that she was looking for that was hidden on the duck. And it was the guy that was in line that was standing behind her. He was going to go back and grab it because he wanted it too. But rather than just telling her in line that he wanted that record, he said, "You know, oh, I'll help you find it. You know, if I see it, I'll let you know." And he hid this record so that he could go back later in the week and grab it. Super sketch, but yeah.
Let's put this on our magnifying glass. Like, let's say he went there and wanted it and didn't know that she wanted it, and she said she wanted it. Would it have been fair game for him to have stumble across it first and grab it and then buy it, or would he, should he have given it to her, you see?
I mean, I would have given it to her, you know, if I didn't go, if I wasn't going there to get this record. Yeah, and you said to her in line, like, you know, I'll help you find it. You know, don't say that if you don't want to help her find it. If you think that you want that record too, you just don't say, oh, you know. I don't know. Yeah, I think that was sketchy.
Fair enough. Let's see here. Chris, I just got a couple last questions for you. Chris, what's like one of the best finds or one of the coolest finds that you've gotten on the cheap?
Well, there's a handful over the years. There's a Delaware Boogie record that's pretty fun called Street Lovin'. It was recorded in Bear, Delaware, 1979. It's a boogie record. There's probably only 200 made, and it's pretty desirable amongst you know, DJs around the world. But I've found this record, I think, four times in Delaware. It often fetch, you know, I sell them for about $150 to $200. Actually helped a guy in Australia get a copy so that he could officially reissue it as well. So I found one for him and then sent it over, and then he dealt with, you know, the rights and all that, you know, finding the remaining living members. That was a fun one. I know you mentioned that Hawkwind. I found that at a thrift store probably just a few months ago. Yeah, lots of stuff over the years. Some of the basement digs are a lot of fun too. You know, if you go out on a house call or a record collection that, you know, somebody's ready to move on, or they're moving and just need to get rid of it. They haven't listened to it in years. You get to dig through their basement. That's some of the best. Some of the best.
Have you ever had any sketchy or weird experiences going to somebody's basement?
I think an attic once was pretty sketchy. You know, I had a headlamp on, not by the person, just you know, moldy, like no electricity. You know, you're up there with a headlamp, you're trying to dig stuff and walk down these sketchy stairs, you know, to get the records down. But I don't think I've ever felt like threatened by any collections. Oh, I will say, tell a story. Probably about 11 years ago, the best record score probably of my life. I was set up selling records at a punk show in Newark, a house show, just outside. I think it was in April, or it was warmer weather. And this university student walks up and, you know, she's looking through. I think she bought a Janis Joplin record from me, and she was saying that her uncle just gave her his record collection, but she didn't know what any of it was. I was like, oh, that's cool. What kind of stuff was it? She was like, I don't know what any of this stuff was. You know, I pulled out a Jimi Hendrix and I kept that. But, you know, he's moving to Thailand. He just gave me his records. And I don't know what any of it is. You know, would you be interested? I was like, definitely. Yeah, you know, here's my number. Give me a call. So about a week later, she calls me up. She says, hey, you want to see these records? And it was the week that my son was born. So I was super busy with that, you know, new father. I was like, oh, you know, we should hold off. You know, I'm kind of busy right now. She's like, well, I don't want anything from you. You can just have them. I can just drop them off to your house if you're busy. I said, sure, let's do it. Right. So she stops by the house. She opens up her trunk, and all these Krautrock records just start falling out, and Magma records, and all these prog records. And, you know, I see Japanese, like Miles Davis, with the Obi strips. And I was like, wow, like, this is really good stuff. You sure you don't want anything for him? She's like, no, you know, I don't know what any of this stuff is. You know, I'm not going to listen to him. I told my uncle, he said he just wants him to go to a good home. I told him that, you know, I might give him to you. I said, well, I'd like to meet your uncle. Like, this is a really cool collection. Like, you know, can I have his email or something just so I can talk to him? She said, yeah, sure. So I asked her again if she wanted anything for him. And I said, you know, if there's ever any records you're looking for, just let me know and I'll find them for you. And they're yours. She said, oh, yeah, cool. So I meet up with the uncle, you know, he was probably in his mid-60s. He lived in Germany in the late 60s, early 70s. He was stationed over there. So he was just buying, like, you know, Can and Faust, and Krautrock records, and, you know, weird electronic stuff. And a little later, you know, punk stuff. There was Suicide Records, all kinds of great shit. So, yeah, he was a good man. He was a good time. But, yeah, he became Buddhist and was just getting rid of all his possessions and moving to Thailand. But that was great.
So, Christian, we'll wrap it up with this. Is what are some of the crown jewels of your collection?
I think the most expensive record I have is a psych folk record called Fresh Maggots. It was from 1970 or 1971 on RCA. But, you know, I'm pretty desirable amongst, like, the acid folk crowd. And I found that locally in a record store. Paid $20 for it. Oh, actually $10 for it, because I had a $10 credit. But I was besides myself when I found this record, because I knew what it was and I had wanted it. And I just quietly, you know, like, went up, paid the $10, and, you know, walked away. That was cool. I don't know. Yeah, I really cherish a lot of my old punk stuff, you know, that I got, you know, when I first started coming up buying records, you know, when they were cheap, you know, that kind of stuff. Some of the hardcore stuff, you know, I held on to it. I have done purges over the years, so I have gotten rid of some stuff, and actually went through a phase where, you know, I told myself I don't really need to have original pressings. You know, I can get $50 for this and just pick up a reissue for 15 or whatever. So I did that a couple times, you know, over the years, got rid of some stuff, but I've since tried to get back, you know, original pressings. But yeah, I don't know. It's all good. I love everything from the record that truly is worth a dollar. You know, like, you and I often talk about, like, the new wave or, like, power pop stuff that we get that's probably not worth much to other people, but, you know, we love. So yeah, to the more desirable ones by, you know, more people.
Well, fair enough. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on the show. Do you want people to check out your Instagram or anything, or?
Sure. Yeah, it's Dusty _fingers_ on Instagram. And I mainly just use that to, you know, post stuff that I find, but also stuff that I'd like to trade, if anybody wants to do trades. But I advertise for the pop-ups on that too. And sometimes I'll do other pop-ups besides the monthly ones. So that's a good way to find out what's happening, what's going on with that. Or yeah, if you want to trade, or if you're looking for stuff that you're trying to find, you know, like I said, I go out digging all the time. So I often find stuff for friends or find stuff for people that they've been looking for.
All right. Well, people definitely check out, if you're in the Delaware area, Philly area, check out Chris's pop-up. It's very cool. Fourth Tuesday of every month at Delaware, no, Wilmington Brew Works, rather. And there's a good pizza place next door. Chris, let's send him out with a song. What tune should we play to sail him on out?
Ooh, that's a good one. You know, just today, I just heard my buds from Philadelphia, they're in a band called Tangled Up, have a new single. And it's really good. I can't remember what it's called, though. Would you be able to find it if you just type in Bandcamp, Tangled Up? It's the new single.
We certainly can. Tangled Up includes who from Jupiter Records as well. Octi?
Yeah, and Kyle also used to work at Jupiter Records at one of the off branches. But yeah, they're since up in Philadelphia now. Singer Dave is also Grace von der Kuhn's band, and Octi also plays in Delaware band Eyeball. But yeah, I'm really digging their new stuff and their sound. So yeah, check them out if you see their name pop up.
And thanks for listening, and we'll see you all later on. Thanks, Chris.
Awesome. Thanks, John. Peace.